Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, are you a giver or taker? What about your friends and loved ones? Are they givers or takers? And what does it even mean if somebody calls you a giver or a taker? What can we learn from it? Well, in his new book, Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success, Wharton Professor Adam Grant reveals how the way we choose to interact with other people defines our success or failure. This is an absolutely fascinating read. And I've read it through and I'm still going back and checking little bits and seeing things a little differently. So this is really interesting. Later today, we'll talk with the author and award-winning writer, Ellen Canner. Her new book is called Feeding the Hungry Ghost, Life, Faith, and What to Eat for Dinner. And that's been described as a delicious read, a mindful and irreverent recipe for a reverend life. Ellen will join us around 12:30 today. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Adam Grant. He is the youngest full professor and single highest rated teacher at Wharton Business School. He's been honored as one of Business Week's favorite professors and one of the world's top 40 business professors under 40. He's received numerous awards and extensive coverage for his research, and he's consulted with just about all of the bigs, Google, NFL, IBM, Merck, the World Economic Forum, and the United Nations. He's a former record-setting advertising director, junior Olympic springboard diver, and professional magician. Very interesting background there. Adam Grant, welcome to the show today.
Thank you, Vicki. Delighted to be here.
And I want to say your book is called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. So how did you go from being a professional magician, or maybe you still are a professional magician, to being a Wharton professor?
Oh, I am long retired. You know, I think that my early interest in magic, you know, a lot of that was the psychology element, you know, trying to understand, you know, what surprised people, what grabbed their attention. And as an introvert, it was a great experience of coming out of my shell and becoming a little more comfortable with public speaking. So I think that thread of psychology carried through, and I've always been fascinated by what makes people tick and what affects the way that they engage with other people.
Right. And so how did that lead you to look at givers and takers specifically? Because, you know, we hear this all the time. I had an aunt who told me, "Honey, there are two kinds of people in this world, givers and takers, and once you've figured out which box they fit in, you're ahead of the game." It's not quite that simple. But how did you get interested in this, Adam?
Well, it's interesting, actually. I'm way behind if you already heard about this idea from your aunt, but I'm going to try to complicate it and tell you there are three kinds of people in the world instead of two, as you know. But before we get there, what I would say is, you know, I was really interested in what makes people successful at work and in life. And I'm an organizational psychologist by training, and when I started reading through a lot of the research, you know, I read all about these individual factors like hard work and talent and luck. And there's no doubt that those are important, but I was really struck by the fact that the world of work is becoming more and more interdependent. You know, we have more organizations using teams. We have a huge growth of the service sector where, you know, your whole job is about interacting with clients and customers. And so, you know, it was really interesting to me that our work lives are made up of other people. And, you know, we didn't have as much to say, you know, in the organizational psychology field about, well, how do those interactions really shape our success? And so I started reading through a lot of the evidence about, well, what kinds of motives do people bring to their interactions? And that's what brought me to givers and takers, as well as that third category of matchers.
Right. So let's just take a look at how you define givers and takers and what we call matchers. What about givers? We think of somebody who's giving, who puts, you know, everything out there for everybody else ahead of themselves, but you actually say there are two kinds of givers.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, overall, givers are people who enjoy helping others and will often do it without any strings attached. You know, you can think about sharing knowledge or making introductions or being a mentor, or giving advice, solving problems. And, you know, you can think about really two different ways of doing that. One is a very selfless approach, which is, you know, putting other people first all the time and exhausting your time and energy and resources. And the other is what I call an otherish approach. That might be a word that never should have been invented. When I think about being otherish, it means, you know, putting other people first a lot of the time, but also being thoughtful about your own goals and ambitions and making sure that your helping and giving doesn't sacrifice those.
Right. And so then takers obviously are those who don't do any of those.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about takers, I think about them as the people who are always trying to get as much as possible from others and don't want to give anything back. You know, they're good at really critical skills like social loafing, you know, the shirking, the free riding, you know, making sure other people do all the boring, unpleasant work, and yet somehow coming out hogging all the credit.
Yeah, I know a few of those. They're often the people who go, oh, well, I'm the ideas person. You guys are the ones here to do the work.
That sounds like a classic taker.
I think sometimes takers can be hard to recognize at first if they're experienced at this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of takers are good fakers. And, you know, what I find, as you know from the book, is there's a common pattern of kissing up, kicking down, where when takers are dealing with powerful people, they want to make a really good impression, and so they create this aura of generosity. But if you're a taker, it is a lot of work to pretend to be helpful with all the people you meet. And so you're going to let your guard down a little bit more when you're dealing with your peers and subordinates who you think are less influential in your life, and that's often, you know, where you get to see true colors.
Right. You do say at some point in the book that, yes, takers can change, and givers who, you know, maybe give too much can change. But do you think this is intrinsic to who we are, basically?
Well, I think like all questions in psychology, it's a combination of nature and nurture. The evidence suggests that when you look at giving behaviors like charitable donations, for example, that about 30% of the variance in charitable giving is genetically explained, which leaves a lot left over for, you know, our life experiences and our choices. And, you know, I think that choice point is really important because these are decisions we make in every interaction we have with another person. So, you know, think about the biggest taker you know, and unless that person is a psychopath or a sociopath, there are probably moments where that person, you know, instead of just trying to get something, offers a trade that's fair and balanced, which is what a matcher would do, and we could talk more about that. Or, you know, even some roles or relationships where that person might operate a little more like a giver and say, you know what, I'm going to try to offer something, and, you know, I'm not really going to expect anything in return. And, you know, I think that as people shift that mindset, they can change their styles over time.
Right. Now, what you just mentioned matchers, and I wanted to ask you, what is how do we differentiate between a matcher and a taker? Because, as you said, they can be difficult to, I think, tell apart at first.
That's right. So, you know, a matcher at the core is somebody who tries to maintain an even balance of give and take. You know, think of people who just live their lives by the norm of reciprocity,
right,
where everything is quid pro quo. You know, if you do me a favor, then I feel like I'm in debt until I paid it back. And, you know, when I help you out, I want an equal favor in return. And what you will find with matchers is they spend a lot of time sort of keeping track, right, of debits and credits. They always want to keep a zero balance sheet. And you could actually, Gretchen Rubin called them the karma police, which I thought was a great term. You know, matchers believe that what goes around comes around, and they really want to see the world as a just and fair place. And so, you know, that means that when somebody's a taker, matchers like to punish that person. And, you know, when somebody's a giver, matchers feel like, well, you know, that should be really rewarded.
Mm.
And so, you know, you won't see takers necessarily going out of their way to sort of restore the scales of justice, whereas, you know, that's often a mission that you will see matchers launch into.
Okay, got it. So let's talk a little bit more about givers and the two types, because you say that it's quite staggering that there are givers way at the top of the spectrum as far as success and way at the bottom because they get burned out. So what is the difference between those two?
Well, you know, I think it comes back to the selfless, otherish distinction, that the really selfless givers are the ones who, you know, end up basically self-sacrificing. You know, they either burn themselves out or they become doormats at the hand of takers because they're really willing to help all the people all the time with all the requests, which is not a recipe for sustainable success. The otherish givers are much more likely to say, look, you know, I'm going to block out time for my own individual productivity. you know, and I'm not going to help everybody all the time with all the requests. I'm going to screen whether somebody that's asking me for help has a history or a reputation of being a taker. And if so, I'm going to be more flexible in my style and be cautious. I find that a lot of the successful givers around us actually end up acting more like matchers when dealing with takers and say, look, you know, if you want my help, then I need a commitment from you to pay it back or pay it forward.
Interesting. So they're more strategic in what they give and who they give to and how they give, and less of a doormat, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. All right. So you say in the book, you say you find something really magnetic about successful givers. Do you remember what that is?
You're challenging me to remember my own writing. Thank you for that, Vicky. You know, it's actually something that's really struck me for a long time, which is that when givers succeed, they actually end up also lifting other people up instead of cutting them down. And you know, I think that's really powerful. That you know, when a taker succeeds, right, it means somebody else is losing, because takers tend to have a very zero sum view of the world and feel like to be successful they have to be better than others. Whereas you know, a giver's success looks much more like a rising tide lifting all boats. You know, as givers succeed, right, part of what they're doing is they're sharing their knowledge and their networks and their time and their energy with other people, and so it's easier for them to bring others with them to the top.
Mm. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, Adam, I'm going to ask you how each of these groups networks successfully and maybe not so successfully. I think that could help a few of us along the way.
Bring it on.
We're going to take a very quick break. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest is Adam Grant. His book is called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. This is really a fascinating read. We'll be right back. Please stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Clear, clean, and crisp. Check us out in digital quality sound on FM 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Adam Grant. His book is called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. And a tremendous amount of research and thought went into this book. It's really insightful. Adam Grant is the single highest rated professor at Wharton. I believe also the youngest, and he's one of the world's top 40 business professors under 40. So he has a lot of experience in talking about this, right, Adam?
guilty as charged, I suppose.
So I want to ask you about, we've been talking about givers and takers and matchers. I want to ask you how each group, or who builds the best network and why?
Well, I think when you look at networks, you're looking for two features. One is depth and the other is breadth. You know, a deep network is basically full of strong ties to people we really trust and are close to and can reach out when we need help. And those, of course, are the people who are willing to give to us. And then, you know, a broad network is more about having weak ties, acquaintances, you know, people who can connect you to novel information and diverse perspectives and viewpoints. And, you know, if when you look at takers, not surprisingly, they tend to have shallower relationships, right? They often sacrifice depth as they go about their self-serving agendas. And they do actually benefit from a lot of breadth. There's some research suggesting that takers tend to have ever-expanding networks because after they take advantage of you, they have to add new people to exploit who don't know about their reputation yet, which is great. So, you know, there's a point for the takers and a point against them.
Okay.
When you look at matchers, Reid Hoffman, who founded LinkedIn, makes a really interesting point that people who go about their lives with a matching mentality tend to build narrower networks. You know, they tend to have deeper connections than takers, obviously, but they don't extend their help to people, you know, unless they think they can help them back, because the whole point of being a matcher is you help so that you can receive an even return. And what that means is they will often miss out on helping people who will one day go on to do great things or who can really challenge their viewpoints or bring in novel perspectives. So givers tend to get the best of both worlds. Unlike matchers, you know, when they help, it feels like they really care about you or they're making a meaningful investment in the relationship as opposed to it being like a transaction or an exchange. So there's a lot of depth and goodwill there. And then in terms of breadth, givers tend to be willing to help a broader range of people, and that means they benefit from a more diverse network. And we can talk to you about the dormant ties that givers benefit from if you want to go there.
Yes, do.
Well, so one of the questions you could raise is how do you get the best of both worlds, of the strong ties and the weak ties? You know, the strong ties give you that trust and shared perspective. The weak ties give you the novel information. And there's this third group of people that are known as dormant ties, who are the people you used to know but lost touch with over the last few years. And studies by Daniel Levin and his colleagues actually show that when you need advice or information, if you reach out to somebody you used to know, you get better knowledge than if you reach out to one of your current contacts. Because just like a weak tie, they've been traveling in different circles and they've been really meeting different people, so they can get you really efficiently to new ideas.
Right.
But unlike a weak tie, like a strong tie, there's also some shared history so that you can reach out to them comfortably. You know, you went to college with them, you grew up across the street, you worked in your first job together, and so you can kind of pick up the relationship where it left off. So it turns out it's pretty hard to reconnect if you're a taker, right? Your dormant ties will close the door to their network and say, you are not welcome back in my life.
Right.
And, you know, matchers have already evened the score, and there's not that reservoir of goodwill, whereas with a giver, right, if you reconnect and you've been generous in the past, those dormant ties are really willing and excited to reconnect.
Interesting. Now, from a psychological or psychology perspective, you say in the book that, you know, that they still have locked horns over whether somebody who chooses to give is coming from an altruistic perspective or from an ultimately selfish perspective. Those are the two viewpoints. What do you think on that?
You know, it's interesting. I think the debate between Batson and Cialdini has been really compelling. And what it shows is that there's probably some truth to both perspectives. I think that, you know, most acts of giving are probably more in the other-ish category. That, you know, when you help somebody else, you genuinely care about that person's well-being, and you also probably enjoy helping. Or, you know, feel like it's the right thing to do. And so there's sort of a selfish and an altruistic side of it, and it's very hard to tease apart those two motives.
Right. I want to talk about something in the book that I think was really interesting, and that's that was job crafting. You know, when people take all this knowledge that you've got in the book, what can they do with it? And one of the things that you talk about in the book was job crafting. Would you share a little on the Google experience with us?
Sure. So job crafting is an idea that was introduced by Amy Rasnesky at Yale and Jane Dutton at Michigan. And it's the idea of basically innovating on your own job description and saying, look, you know, there's no reason why I have to do my job exactly as it was written. I have unique interests and strengths and values, and I can make modifications by adding tasks or introducing new interactions or delegating things away that kind of changed the experience of my job. And at Google, Amy and Justin Berg and I partnered up with Jennifer Kirkowski and Brian Welly, and we designed a little experiment to see what would happen if Google employees were given the chance to think about crafting their jobs in a more structured way. So they basically mapped out the building blocks of their job, they thought about their interests, strengths, and values, and then they really reconfigured their jobs, making a visual map of what they wanted them to look like. And the key was that they had to be more ideal but still realistic. And we randomly assigned Googlers to different versions of this, and lo and behold, the average Google employee who went through a two-hour exercise to reimagine his or her job over the next 6 months achieved gains in happiness and in job performance, as rated by direct managers and coworkers. And, you know, I think it's a really powerful experience to say, look, you know, you could help the people around you by enabling them to craft or modify their jobs, and you could also craft your job to change your interactions.
Yeah, makes perfect sense to me. A couple of fun things I wanted to look at. Thinking about Superman makes people less likely to volunteer. How so?
As a Superman fan, I was dismayed by that finding. Nelson and Norton actually show that when you get people to write down the characteristics of Superman, they're less likely to volunteer. And the reason is that Superman seems to be an impossible standard. When people think about, you know, being faster than a speeding bullet and more powerful than a locomotive, they just think, well, I can't be that helpful and heroic, so why should I bother? Now, interestingly, if you just, instead of Superman, if you get them to list the characteristics of a superhero, then they're actually more likely to volunteer, because at that point, they're able to connect some of the abstract ideas that they list to things they could actually do.
Oh, that's interesting. So many people spend a lot of time on Facebook and things like that today, and you say we can tell very quickly what if somebody's a taker. And in fact, we could have avoided a very major crisis in this country with Enron if we had known this fact at that time. So talk to us about the Facebook profile and Enron.
Well, sure. So the Bruffardi and Campbell show that if you want to recognize narcissistic takers on Facebook, one of the cues is vainer, more self-glorifying photos. And, you know, I like to point out that the narcissistic takers among us are not attractive to a greater degree than anyone else.
Right.
But there's a greater gap between how they look every day and how hot they are in that profile photo. Because if you're a taker, you have to put your best foot forward, right?
Right.
So take that to Enron. There's actual data, Chatterjee and Hambrick show that the narcissistic taker CEOs among us actually have more prominent photographs of themselves. So in their company's annual reports, they're more likely to be pictured alone and have these giant photos that take up a whole page. And sure enough, if you go to the 1997 Enron annual report, 4 years before the company collapsed, you will find a full-page picture of Ken Lay alone. And I think it's one of many cues that there were some takers at the helm of Enron.
Mm. How can we make money by giving money away? That's another one of the fun facts in here.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me as well. Arthur Brooks actually shows that when you earn more income 1 year, of course, you're more likely then to give more money away. But he also shows that every dollar you give away yields you about $3.75 more income. How could you make money by giving it away? Well, economists can't explain this. So Brooks turns to psychology and argues that when you give money away, it adds a little bit of joy and meaning to your life, and that motivates you to work harder so that you can give more away.
Isn't that interesting? Do you? That is interesting.
Who would have thought?
Yeah, who would have thought? You can't help but put a book together like this and not look at yourself and your own behavior. So I'm guessing I know which one you are, but where do you put yourself on the giver-taker categories?
Well, I don't actually feel like it's my place to judge. I think that, you know, our styles of give and take are in the eye of the beholder.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'll say is that I really aspire to live as much as I can by giver principles. But that whether I succeed or not is up to the people I interact with to evaluate.
Okay, well, that's very modest. So we're going to assume you're not a taker there. I don't think a taker would say that too much.
Or maybe just a taker who studied this stuff for a long time.
There you go. So what was your key takeaway from putting all of this work together and all of the research? Was there something that just really blew your mind, Adam?
Something that blew my mind, well, you know, I guess what I'll say is, you know, there's a really powerful idea that I'd never thought about before until I started doing the research that now I try to build into every day. Adam Rifkin, who you know from the book, was named Fortune's Best Networker.
Right.
It's just this amazingly inspiring example of a successful giver. And one of the things he recommends is he says, look, you don't have to be Gandhi or Mother Teresa. You can do a lot of five-minute favors. And, you know, really find ways of adding a lot of value to other people's lives that are low cost to you. And, you know, learning from Adam about that has really affected the way that I think. You know, he's always making introductions and, you know, he's in Silicon Valley. So he's looking, if you're an entrepreneur, to find you a co-founder or a tech expert. And, you know, it just takes them a couple minutes to make these sometimes life-changing connections for people. And I think we can all find ways to do more five-minute favors in our daily lives.
I think that's a good note to end our segment on. Adam Grant, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule and being with us today.
Thank you, Vicky. It was a treat.
And the book, again, is called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. It really is a good read. It's fun and very, very interesting. And Adam's website is giveandtake.com. Spell that out, giveandtake.com. You can find out more about Adam and his work there. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Next week on Conversations Live, Vicky talks with the exquisite and award-winning writer Dani Shapiro. Her latest national bestseller is Still Writing, The Perils and Pleasures of a Creative Life. We'll also select books as holiday gifts with Karen West, events coordinator for Book Passage, a New York Times reporting and award-winning bookstore based in the San Francisco Bay Area. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD Channel 3.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO. Copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Tired of the insanity of other talk radio stations? Just click your radio knob and say there's no place like Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, I'm pleased to have with me now Ellen Canner. She's an award-winning food writer, Huffington Post's Meatless Monday blogger, and the syndicated columnist, The Edgy Veggie. I had to be careful how I said all that. It was a bit tongue-tricky there. Her work has been published in Bon Appetit, Eating Well, Vegetarian Times, Every Day with Rachel Ray, and Culinate, as well as other print online and print publications. She's an advocate for sustainable, accessible food and has served on the Miami boards of Slow Food and Common Threads. And that's where she lives, in Miami. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, we're pleased to have you. And I want to say the name of Ellen Canner's new book is called Feeding the Hungry Ghost, Life, Faith, and What to Eat for Dinner. Love, love, love that title, Feeding the Hungry Ghost. So let's start there then. Why this title?
Hungry ghosts are a Tao concept. In Asia, there are actual celebrations where you honor the people who were hungry and needy and clutchy in real life, so much so that they stayed that way even after they died. So if you want to, you know, kind of bring down that energy, there are prayers you can say, and you also give food offerings. So basically, you're showing compassion in a really primal way. And, you know, the same trick works for us. We are so crazy and busy and clutchy and needy that we forget how to be kind to ourselves and to each other. And I'm thinking we are all just so hungry for meaning, for connection, for all the things we know we need, but we turn to, like, junk food instead. Seems easier.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. The book has been described as a mindful, meatless, and irreverent recipe for a reverent life. Feeding the Hungry Ghost is a delicious read. And it's I would describe it as a series of essays that you combine with your, you know, related to certain recipes that you give throughout the book. How did you come up with a concept for the book?
Well, you were kind enough to mention some of the places I write for. I love writing about food, but I would, by nature of the publication, I would only be able to feature, you know, seasonal ingredients or a chef or a health aspect of something. And to me, we bring our whole selves to the table. So I really wanted to invite all of us in, and I thought stories were a great way to do that. Food is a much bigger story.
Right, right. So you are vegan yourself, but let's go back a few years, Ellen. You grew up in a family that basically didn't eat much produce.
and still doesn't, other than me.
Right. So, and then in a fit of rebellion, I read when you were a teenager, you were like, well, I'm not going to eat meat for 2 weeks. I'll show my parents. And this became a way of life for you. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I did know myself well enough at 13 to know that forever was a very long time. But 2 weeks seemed like a manageable experiment. I did it because I love animals. But I found I didn't miss meat at all. And I had always, it seemed like I had a stuffy nose for the first, you know, 13 years of my life. Mm-hmm. That went away. That was really great. I felt better. I had more energy and I didn't miss meat, and my parents were still annoyed at me. So this was worth keeping on.
So and your husband, you are married. Your husband is vegan too, right?
He is leaning that way. I call him an exuberant omnivore.
Love it. Well, I also love the fact that, you know, you say, I'm not just about feeding vegans. I'm about feeding people. I love, you want your whole, you know, dinner table full of people. Just, you want delicious food.
Right. And you know, sometimes if you're talking to someone who isn't familiar with the concept, they get what I call that little flash of panic in the eyes when the word vegan comes up.
Right.
But if I say, okay, you know what's for dinner tonight? I've got this fabulous lentil curry with ginger and chilies and garlic.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that doesn't sound so bad. I could probably eat that. Because it's summer here. I mean, we are just like in the throes of summer and it's mango season. So what if I made some quinoa with mango and chili and mint?
When are you inviting me over? Sounds pretty good to me.
I love getting people together for good food.
One of the things you talk about is how important it is to have that connection. It's not about dinner. It's the connection, because so many people have lost that. You know, and I remember growing up, we didn't always have family dinner with my dad because he worked late. But the kids certainly, and my mom would all sit down together. And we've lost so much of that with people eating and running, you know, on the go all the time.
I know. And we do seem to be very busy. I'm not denying that. But I think it's the one few minutes of the day we can carve out for ourselves and each other, and it's recharging, it's energizing. That is a really vital connection. And I think that's what gives us the stamina and the strength to go back into the fray with a smile.
Yes, and you know, there are studies, are there legitimate studies, because I've seen them when we've done previous shows, that prove that families that eat together are more likely to stay together, which is pretty significant, I think.
It is, and it hugely benefits children's behavior. You know, kids who are diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and, you know, the parents want to throw Ritalin at them, try getting them to, you know, try it once a week, a family meal. It's really balancing, and I bet you wind up liking it too.
Right, right. So you wrote, let me just find the quote here, because this was an interesting quote, I thought. You said in the book, every time I start to write about faith, I wind up writing about food. Talk to us a little about that, if you would.
I mean, everyone has something they believe in or don't. For me, it doesn't have to happen in a church or any kind of place of worship. It happens for me in the kitchen. I'm more interested in who we are, you know, when we sit down and gather. And, you know, that's part of the Bible, too. They sat together and broke bread. I thought, well, gosh, you know, it's not that revolutionary an idea to do. This has been part of our culture. This is what binds us. It's what civilizes us sometimes.
Right, right. And so you refer to the fact that you're Jewish in the book, but you say also, I envy people who take comfort in faith that God will provide. I'm not entirely sure I believe in God. And you talk then about how you can find, you know, faith in church or temple, but also in a garden, a school, a kitchen. And you say cooking is its own meditation. Do you invite other people to come cook with you?
I have been doing that more and more. I have to say that I used to feel like if you came to my house, you were a guest and you shouldn't have to lift a finger. But sometimes that's the kitchen is where the party is. So I want everyone to come in. Although sometimes my husband says it's dangerous because I move very fast, we sort of learned to tango together. Like he knows when I'm coming towards the stove that he needs to retreat. Then it's kind of funny watching us in the kitchen together, but I do love it. I love having people near me and messing with me and you know, saying, "Oh, you know, I've never made it that way," or, you know, "Why are you putting in all that chili?"
Right. One of the favorite times of my life. It's happened many years ago, but this was always a favorite for me. I used to, my sister-in-law was a stay-at-home mom back then, and my nephew was about 3. And so I would take him every Saturday because I worked full-time, and it was such a delight to be with him at the weekend. I would take him every Saturday, and we would bake lasagna and cakes and pastries together. And he's almost 30 now, but when I go back to England, that's what we still do together.
See, I think that is so, so wonderful. It's not just the lasagna and the cakes. It is something he thinks about and treasures. It's you created memories as well as meals.
Right, right. And it's very special for me, too.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about some of the travel stories that you share in the book. There are some interesting tales there. My guest in this segment is Ellen Canner. Her book is called Feeding the Hungry Ghost, Life, Faith, and What to Eat for Dinner. And again, this is a great book. It's funny, irreverent, but it's also very insightful. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Now,
Next week on Conversations Live, Vicki talks with the exquisite and award-winning writer Dani Shapiro. Her latest national bestseller is still writing, The Perils and Pleasures of a Creative Life. We'll also select books as holiday gifts with Karen West, events coordinator for Book Passage, a New York Times reporting and award-winning bookstore based in the San Francisco Bay Area. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD Channel 3.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to BioClean, we cover the world of animals. This week, December 1st, we'll unleash the jingle cats and dogs. We'll talk with relationship whisperer and author Jonna Rosewood. Bob Vella joins us to talk about what's new with canine caviar. And from Whispering Dragon, acutonics specialist Jude and Paul Ponton join us to tell us all about a super inexpensive holiday gift they have available. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I'm talking with Ellen Canna. She's an award-winning food writer and the author of Feeding the Hungry Ghost, Life, Faith, and What to Eat for Dinner. And I'm going to share this quote with you. I've shared it before, but I'll share it again because I think this quote brilliantly describes the book. It's a mindful, meatless, and irreverent recipe for a reverent life. Feeding the Hungry Ghost is a delicious read. It made me hungry when I was reading it. Ellen, you shared some travel stories and some stories of ethnic food. And one of the stories I enjoyed was the story of the beans from Egypt. So talk to us a little bit about your experience with that, if you would.
I was actually just on a panel where we were talking about immigrant experience. And there was a Haitian American and a Jordanian American. And I'm a fourth generation Floridian. So what was I doing there? The thing is, as we talk about immigration reform, we forget that we were all from somewhere else. And I like to talk about the things that really tie us together. Almost every culture has a bean or whole grain dish. That's what sustained them. Before there was fast food, before there was processed food, it is food that is so good for us, that is. Beans are the only crop that actually nourish the soil as well as us, so what's not to love?
Oh, I didn't know they nourished the soil, too.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was, you know, before my garden burns up, I'm going to plant some field peas to put the nitrogen back in the soil. Makes it beautiful.
Oh, interesting. There you go.
And
that's a good tip.
In the Fertile Crescent, the dish of Egypt is fool. It's fava beans. And, you know, they've been growing there. They've been part of the civilization since the dawn of civilization. It's the people's food. So, yes, I get very passionate about beans.
You lived in Japan for a while. One of the things I remember reading from that story was that they have festivals every weekend. Talk to us a little bit about your experience in Japan and some of the foods that you really enjoyed there.
It's a wonderful culture. It is a very different culture. I got to try homemade tofu, and I still, you know, I really just see the artisanal passion that would go into making vats and vats of this. And here we're still a little squeamish about it. There, again, it's another bean dish. Remember, it comes from soybeans. It's part of it's like a ribbon that runs through that culture. And there would always be street festivals with tofu, also grilled squid on a stick, which I was not, you know, that obviously wasn't for me, and that was okay.
Right. Now, did you try it? I know you're vegan, but when you go to foreign places, do you try delicacies like that? Because they do consider it a delicacy.
They do, and that's why it's good to be married to an omnivore. Sometimes he has to eat for two.
There you go. And I read also that you went to, and I believe it was China, they actually have a Hungry Ghost Festival. What was that like?
It's different. In Japan, it's sort of very sedate, and we get together and we tidy up our ancestors' graves, and we have a little cup of tea and maybe some fruit, and we go home. In China, it's a little more edgy and aggressive. There, they just sort of want these freaky ancestors to go away, and they'll do whatever it takes. So the temples are absolutely thick with jaw sticks. They're burning all kinds of stuff, and it's not fruit and tea. It's cigarettes and whiskey, because apparently this is what they liked when they were alive. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's they're dead now, so what can you do? It's kind of wild and exciting and energizing.
Do you have a favorite country and favorite food?
Do I have a favorite food? Well, it's not like I have a pet recipe. I do gravitate to beans a lot. And the wonderful thing about them is you can do anything with them. I mean, I have Caribbean recipes. I have Haitian recipes. I have Middle Eastern recipes. I have Moroccan recipes. So just for sheer versatility, you can't beat a bean.
Well, you know, I'm not a bean fan. I think this is why I'll never be vegan. But you do make it look appetizing in the book. So tell me some of the tricks that you use to make beans more appetizing.
My tricks are two: spices and fresh produce. They make everything more delicious. Also, and they're fantastic for us. The spices I most love also happen to be very good for us. Cinnamon and cumin are warming spices that are great for circulation. They're good for respiration. Turmeric is like antibacterial. This is like great stuff. Also, I am desperate to get greens into people. And, you know, if you hand someone a bowl of spinach, they're mostly going to look at you like you're weird. But if you kind of dress it up with some chickpeas and some olive oil and some lemon juice and some garlic, well, okay, then you've got something there.
Mm-hmm.
So greens, I use beans as my Trojan horse.
There we go.
To get greens into people.
I'd rather have the greens myself and leave the beans.
Oh, good for you. Oh, we're going to get along great.
I've always loved vegetables, so don't ask me why I have weight issues. I have no excuse. Well, that brings me on to my next question, because you say in the book, you believe that food is a metaphor for life and that our relationship with food is a metaphor for relationship with everything else. You say nasty food habits, toxic life decisions. Talk to us a little about that.
Well, really, what is more precious than you? And if you're just going to feed yourself food that has, okay, might have a momentary thrill, but look, we know more about what goes in our food than we ever, ever have. So you need to be paying attention. And if you're not, you're not being really good to yourself. And if you're not being good to yourself, you're probably crabby at work. You're probably crabby at home. You matter. And our planet matters. If you eat better, you're more capable of making better decisions, and the world will be a better place. It all starts with you mm-hmm. and what you eat for dinner.
I can't disagree with you. I think it makes perfect sense. One of the arguments that I sometimes use, and I know other people do too, is I don't have time to cook. And I know that's garbage. I do know that's garbage. But talk to us a little bit. When people say to you, Ellen, I don't have time to cook, What do you say to them?
I say there are a lot of different ways around it. I do have one recipe in there. I prepared after a hurricane when I didn't have any power and I was kind of desperate. It took 10 minutes. It still takes 10 minutes. You probably have 10 minutes. I also have a lot of recipes, a lot of bean recipes, it turns out, that you do the work once, you make it once, You can eat it during the week, or you can freeze it in individual portions, and you have got fabulous, healthy, homemade fast food that'll be ready when you want it. How can you beat that?
Mm-hmm. You're very big on seasons, eating and taste the seasons. Now, you know, when I was a kid and my mother sent me grocery shopping, it would be get dark green curly cabbage in the winter and spring cabbage in the spring. Now it's just cabbage.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So how do we eat for the seasons and know that we're doing right there?
We check out our local farmers markets. And here, I'm really, really happy to say we have more farmers markets in the last few years than we have ever had, ever. Something like close to 8,000. So there's probably one near you. I am so pumped about this, because we are getting more connected to where our food comes from. So ask around. I mean, see what's gorgeous and what your local farmer is selling. Not only is the food going to be delicious because it's super fresh, you will be helping your community, because when you spend a dollar at the grocery store, it's a dollar gone to the grocery store. If you spend a dollar at your local farmer's market, that money stays in your community. So you're helping your local farmer, you're helping yourself, and you have great food.
Right. You talk a lot about connection in the book, and you say it's really important that we connect our meals with the seasons. Is that one of the primary reasons, that sense of community building and supporting the community?
I'm big on multitasking, and I'm easily overwhelmed, too. So if we can just take it back to, you know, I would love to be able to change the world, cure cancer, end war. I can make myself a good dinner from great local ingredients, and I'm still doing pretty good.
Now, a lot of people associate fasting with greater spiritual insight. You talk about this in the book. You don't, though, however. How so?
A little more than I did when I wrote the book. And by fasting, I don't mean going without food. I mean being a little more aware of the ebbs and flows of the season. Like, in addition to being mango season, it is lychee season. It is my favorite time of the year. I mean, these fruits are so sweet, so sexy, so ripe and juicy, and they only last a few weeks. So I enjoy them in their season. And, like, I have made a lunch of lychees, I totally admit it. And when it's over, I just say, thank you, that was terrific. And I do without. And it sort of puts me back in the rhythm of the planet, which is not that hard to do, and the planet is grateful.
Right. I know you're big on sustainability. What do you really want people to take away from the book, Ellen, when they read it? There's so much information in there. I mean, I think there are so many ways you can come at the book and so much you can take away from it.
Oh, well, thank you. I want people to feel empowered, encouraged, that you do have the possibility every day to do something good for your planet and good for yourself and good for your wallet and have something delicious to eat.
And I'm going to ask you this real quick because we've only got a few seconds left, but you do address this in the book, why French women are thin even though they eat cheese and croissants. What's your take on that?
If you've ever been to France, you know, talk about more than 10 minutes at the table. Wow, they just really indulge. They make the meal a sensual focus. This is where they spend some good time. It's where you can spend some good time, too.
Right, right. I agree. Having spent quite a bit of time in France, they do make it into a big, big connecting thing with them. We are right at the end of our segment. Please let me have your website to give to people. I know it's not your name, so it's Ellen-Inc, is that correct?
I-N-K. So yes, Ellen-Inc.com. That would be terrific. Would love to hear from you guys.
All right, thank you. Ellen Kammer, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time today.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
And Ellen's book is called Feeding the Hungry Ghost, Life, Faith, and What to Eat for Dinner. And it's a very, very enjoyable read. Recipes in there, stories in there, some laughs in there, and some very thought-provoking ideas, too. Well, we have to run out of here today. We're right at the end of our segment. If you want to get hold of us, there are several ways you can reach us. You can get me at info@conversationslive.net, and conversations is plural, info@conversationslive.net. You can also reach me through the 800 number, which is 495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can find me at Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and Facebook Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we'll be back next week with an all-new show. Please do join us next Monday if you can. If not, you can catch a podcast at conversationslive.net. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.